This is the Finding Backcountry podcast, episode number 8, with Adam Weatherby.
Welcome to the Finding Backcountry podcast with your host, Dustin Whitwer.
I am Dustin Whitwer, and this is the Finding Backcountry podcast. Follow along on my journey of learning from the best backcountry hunters each week as we explore valuable information I use to find success in the backcountry. Let's get to the show. Well, we'll jump into it. I know you're a busy guy, so just for the maybe one person out there who's going to listen to this that doesn't know who you are and who Weatherby is, sure. I've got Adam Weatherby on the line today, and I'll just let you jump in and talk about briefly about your background, and we'll go from there.
Sure, absolutely. I'm running a family business that's been around since 1945. So we're kind of in our 72nd year business, and truly is kind of one of those like post World War II entrepreneur type of things that my grandpa did. My grandpa grew up in Kansas and kind of gained his love for the outdoors there. His parents farmed, and he was dirt poor, had 7 older sisters, kind of your classic story. And, you know, kind of started getting his love for the outdoors, like trapping for neighbors and shooting crows for a nickel for neighbor farmers and all that. And just as a kid, literally in kind of the World War I era, kind of grew up out there. And then he moved out to California and started kind of, you know, going on some hunting trips and different things, and moved out west. And kind of saw when the necessity for bullets to move a little faster and shoot a little farther and a little flatter, and was really into hand loading and started to have some kind of different philosophies that if he could get a bullet moving faster, that it'd provide for a cleaner, quicker kill. And not only for the trajectory, but also just for the energy that's left, when foot pounds of energy when it connects with that animal. And so it was out of that in the 40s, Weatherby began, and it was really him kind of reloading in his garage and fireforming brass and doing different things to kind of really push the envelope of, ballistics. And that's when things started. And so here I am 72 years later, third generation, running the family business.
So when you say he was fireforming brass, was he actually machining his own calibers at that point?
Well, at the beginning, yeah, he was doing a little bit of machining combined with fireforming. So he took like the 300 H&H, the 300 Weatherby kind of got, originally kind of, out of that. But then, really he was one that kind of pioneered a bit of two different things in our cases, and that is the belted Magnum and then our rounded Venturi shoulder, which is, when you see a case immediately and it has that rounded shoulder rather than the straight walls, that's how you recognize it. So those two things were done from him, in the early stages, and that's what really kind of set Weatherby apart at the time.
What is the advantage of that rounded shoulder? Because that's always a question.
Sure. Absolutely. I mean, that's how, that's how it gets seated in the chamber. And it's, it gives it, just a little bit more powder capacity. And so that was, one of his initial things is, okay, wait, if we can, take this same case and just kind of round things out, we're giving it just a few more percent, of actual kind of powder capacity in there. Sure. And so that was his, initial thing. Part of it was just being different. He was, competing against guys on the East Coast. He was out West, and a lot of what he did at the beginning, even in California, was with a lot of celebrities, and, there's pictures of John Wayne, of Roy Rogers, and everything he did was just a little bit different, He was kind of the rebel from the West, kind of competing against everybody else on the East Coast, and so everything he did was a little bit like that, and so there's other different, arguments as to why it's an advantage, but a lot of those could be, there's different arguments out there about, if it's legit or not, about what makes that advantage, better or not. But yeah, it's really been just kind of our signature look that we've had, for a long time. Good. And there's a way that the powder actually flows out, and so in the burn, that it's a better burn rate, all those kind of things. But sure, again, those can be argued. So.
Yeah. So it looks like 1945 originally started with three cartridges, the 257, the 270, and the 300 Weatherby mags. And then
you did your homework.
I did a little bit of homework. Yeah, I've been looking forward to this one. And then just almost like clockwork, you know, every couple of years, every 2 years, 3 years after that, just like spitting out a new innovation. That's got to be, I mean, talk about the drive that he had and kind of the personality trait that it would take to be innovative.
He was as type A as you get. You know, the reason why we're successful and, you know, the reason why even a family business can last as long as it did was what he did with the brand. And so he was, you know, in both the ballistics and his ideas as an inventor, as an entrepreneur, he had the skills there, but he also was a marketer. And so he, you know, my dad always jokes that when my dad was growing up as a kid, his family vacations were load up in the station wagon, drive from California to Florida and back and visit everybody that has an FFL between coast to coast and just schmooze with them. And that's
purely business.
I mean, he lived and breathed Weatherby Incorporated. Every single thing he did, everybody he met. And today, even all the time, I get guys, a lot of old timers. I met your grandfather at the 1977 NRA show. I met your grandfather here. I get guys that'll say, talked to a guy recently up in the Midwest, gun shop owner. I remember when your grandfather walked into my shop right when I set up 30 years ago, and he told me this, and he'll give me word for word. And so the drive that he had and just kind of that old timer mentality, and it still is a relational industry today. And, you know, it's those of us that are in the industry, you know, at all the shows and different places you meet and shake people's hands, and a lot of relationships we have are that my grandpa formed. I mean, Norma Ammunition over in Sweden still does majority of our stuff for ammo. And that relationship was right around 1960. We have a lot of relationships that go back a lot of years, and a lot of that's due to my grandpa really setting up, you know, the foundation for things or with different conservation groups. We're at the NRA show. We are the second longest exhibitor next to Brownells. We've exhibited, 60 some odd years in a row without missing a year. And so, you know, it's really kind of, you know, establishing those relationships. So it was the drive for the product that he had. And then it was also, you know, on the marketing side, didn't have a lot of money. I mean, he sold my grandma's farm in Kansas for, I don't know, hardly anything to help fund the business. And I mean, you know, there's these letters you read of him borrowing money. And I mean, he had nothing. He had absolutely $0 to start with. And so his drive is what had to, you know, have him persevere when I think a lot of other people would have given up.
How important was it then that was his passion? I mean, you know, if he was just doing some XYZ job, selling widgets or whatever that he wasn't as passionate about, do you think it would have, he would have been successful? Yeah.
Not at all. And I mean, even, you know, in the early years, he did a lot of trips to Africa. And in the 50s, that was kind of, you know, getting on an airplane, getting on a jet, flying over there. I mean, heck, he even teamed up with the airlines. I think he got TWA to pay for him to fly over there or something because he didn't have any money to get there. And, you know, when he got there, that was his testing ground, you know. So it was the passion for the outdoors and the hunting, but as much as that, it was the passion for his high velocity theories and really wanting to kind of prove himself right in that, and really wanting to let people know that, you know, faster is better. And so a lot of his hunting was built around that. And so he went to Africa back in the time where permits and tags and all that kind of stuff sure as heck isn't what it is today. Unfortunately, conservation isn't what it is today either, you know, because obviously we're doing a lot of great things there today. But it was his, you know, testing on things like that. It was his passion to, I want to go to Africa and I want to, you know, see the effects of this on plains game or on dangerous game or whatever those things are. And so certainly it was his drive, you know, that led him to those things.
What similarities do you see in yourself or even your dad that are similar to your grandpa?
Yeah, I'm a very driven, passionate person myself, and so I connect with a lot of the things that I read about my grandpa on different ends. And you know, it's kind of like, you know, with your parents, or you get married and you have two sets of parents, yours and your wife's or whatever, and you always go, hey, I want to take the good traits, things that I learn and read about or things that I've experienced. So I hope that I can, you know, certainly do that within, you know, within the business. And so I think, you know, my dad, his personality is a little, what's the word, more than me. Well, he's more mellow. He's a little more kicked back and laid back. But yet people respect him immensely in the industry and know that he's somebody who, you know, everybody says, your dad is just a heck of a nice guy, you know. No, that's not necessarily what they'd say about my grandpa, not that he wasn't a nice guy. My grandpa was just driven. And so he probably mowed some people over in the years. My dad didn't mow anybody over. My dad's just one of the nicest guys that you'll meet. And his employees know that. They know that, you know, faith and family are kind of the, you know, big foundation of who we are as a family. People know that about my dad. He's going to care about people more than he's going to care about the success of the business. And so I hope to be able to blend kind of the passion, the care about people, a little bit of everything. So I try to, try to hopefully do that. Certainly the passion for the outdoors exists, you know, with me, but also driven towards success. I mean, when I look at our brand, you know, our brand is something I don't think we've grown into. And I think that's my job over these next couple decades is to truly leverage our brand and to grow into it. Our brand is, you know, frankly, is bigger than we are. And a lot of that's, you know, due to my grandfather, my father, and, you know, what they did before me. And, so I just got to not screw this thing up.
I think you're doing fine. when did you, you know, I'm sure most of your life, but I mean, when did you really realize that you were part of something special?
Yeah, no, I mean, off and on, you know, growing up as a kid, but you know, some of those things you really take for granted, understanding, you know, you're a Weatherby and what that means and not to take it lightly. I actually left the business for a while during my adult life, and I did ministry, church ministry and missions and those things, again, kind of pursuing one of my passions, you know, which is people and the Lord, and kind of did that. And you know, but yet was always a, you know, new professionally, was always a Weatherby. And so I'd, you know, of course, growing up, worked in, you know, marketing department, service department, tech support, the sales department, you know, all those things, even through college, you know, doing all that. And so it was always like, you know, even now I have two teenage kids and it's always like, look, we don't want to force you into this. This is, you know, this is here and this is available. And, you know, there's certain guidelines you set up, you know, in order for your kids to kind of work here. And, you know, and so I think kind of growing up, always knew that it was there from an occupational standpoint. And so there's different parts of it. You see it as the occupational part. You see it as the just kind of living the brand and being the voice, you know, of the company and, you know, those different things. There's so many different kind of aspects of it, but it was really, I think, as I saw my dad getting more towards retirement, that it really became evident of, the opportunity that was, you know, before me. Otherwise, I think when you're young, you kind of grow up and you just go, oh, yeah, well, dad's doing this and he'll probably always do it. And,
right.
You know, he's like, hey, I've been doing it for 40 years and I don't really want to do it till I die.
Right.
So, you know, my grandpa did kind of that first generation entrepreneur. I mean, he worked up till the day he died almost. And, you know, I think, you know, my dad's got 10, 11 grandkids, something like that. And so him and mom wanted some time and all those things. And so, you know, as he started kind of slowing down, it really started me going, hey, look at this opportunity and the incredible opportunity it is to lead this into the future. And I think really one of the things that excited me is not just carrying it on and maintaining it, but like I said, truly leveraging the brand and truly being, being the Weatherby that I think that we can be. And so as we've assembled a team and kind of formed a team and have future goals, it's not to stay alive. It's to truly grow into, I think, who we can truly become. And that's what really excites me, is not necessarily who we are today, although that is, but it's, I think, who we can become as well.
Right. Transition a little bit here. Talk about your most memorable backcountry hunt.
Man.
On the spot.
Putting
you
on
the spot.
I think probably my doll sheep and caribou hunt in Northwest Territories. Now that hunt, you know, it was a bit of cheating in the fact that we did get dropped off in a helicopter, but then we didn't see life for, you know, any human being for the next 8-9 days. And so it was, you know, backpacking gear, and so everything they can fit in a helicopter, which isn't a lot, and drop you off and, you know, have an inreach to give them a call if there's either emergency or if you tag out. And so, you know, being that far north, that far removed, and literally millions of acres, the area that we hunted, nobody'd hunted at in years. So really, really, really being out there, you know, in the elements for that period of time. We did a little 11-minute short film on it called Proving Grounds. And I think one of the things that was memorable about it was, you know, it was my first sheep hunt, first time being that far north and all that. But I think in addition, the 65300 Weatherby had just come out, and so it was going to be, the doll sheep was going to be the first animal taken with that if I were to, you know, fill the tag. And so it was really kind of a step back to what my grandpa did going to Africa. For me, for my grandpa, Africa was maybe his testing grounds. For me, I prefer the backcountry. I prefer, you know, North American Western game. That's probably my passion. And so for me, that's the name of the film is Proving Grounds. Sure, it was me physically. It was the firearms, but really it was the cartridge. It was a little bit of everything of kind of the proving and testing grounds for that. And so that was a super memorable hunt.
That's big country up there. How far of a shot did you end up taking on that sheep?
It was only about, it was under 300, maybe, I can't remember now, 275, yeah. 380, something like that. So I had the 65300, you know, zeroed out to, you know, bazillion yards and everything.
I was going to ask, what is that 65300 actually capable of?
Right. It's capable of a lot more. That's for sure. I mean, it's really the flattest shooting round out there that's available. You know, it's funny, the day before we saw this band of rams and they were at 700 and some odd yards and couldn't really get in range and the wind was blowing and started raining and some wolves came and scared them off. And so I thought, oh man, how are we going to ever find these guys again? And there were seven rams, two mature rams and then five younger ones. And then the next day we decided to hike around the backside of this mountain the day before we went up and over, and it was a nasty day. I actually sprained my ankle, and still today, 2 years later, I tore a ligament and need surgery that I've been avoiding. So it's been a hard thing. But that next day we hiked around the backside, and literally we came up, and the one ram I wanted to shoot out of the seven was all by himself, 300 yards away, just munching on something on the side of a hill. So it was kind of a meant-to-be moment with him. So.
Do you think hunters are starting to shoot too far these days?
I do. I mean, everybody has their opinion on it. You know, I read an article on the Burger website recently, and I think they really did, you know, of Burger Bullets, did a great job at explaining, you know, how far is too far. You know, we have there's a guy named Mark Thompson, Mark and Scott Thompson out of Utah.
Pier in Utah.
You know those guys with Thompson Long Range. And I think, you know, those guys do a great job of really they give the whole understanding. Their whole program is built around our calibers, really, namely the 257, the 3378, and the 65300, which are big neck downs, you know, which are really pushing bullets, screaming fast. And their whole thing is, hey, if you connect in the right spot, and that's the key, if you connect in the right spot, obviously our cartridges, say a 65 Creedmoor versus a 65300 Weatherby, is you're going to carry that energy out there a heck of a lot further. And you know, whether you want to, you know, whatever your number is for that magic number on, you know, foot pounds of energy, it carries it out a lot further. So our calibers are able to carry that energy out there further than the rest of the calibers out there. So then that begs the question, that's what the rifle will do, but then it's what will the shooter do? What about the elements? What about wind? All those sort of things. This year, for instance, I did two back-to-back elk hunts. I did one in Wyoming, and then I drew a tag in Unit 34 in New Mexico and did a public land, you know, do-it-yourself hunt down there. And the first hunt I had, I actually did not fill my Wyoming elk tag. And one day I had an elk, and I had the 65300. I had an elk at 580 yards, but I don't know if you've hunted much in Wyoming, but it happened to be a windy day in Wyoming, which is like most days.
Yeah.
And it was probably 25, but it was just gusting and all over the place. And I had a shot at, it was right under 600 yards. It was like 585, I think, when we ranged them. And I didn't take the shot. And I did not end up filling my tag. We blew a couple stalks the next couple days, and I had to bail down to this New Mexico hunt because I drew a really good tag and bailed out and went down there. You know, I had a shot at 525 yards with a 300 Weatherby with no wind. I could be prone. I was 100% confident, and it was a hard long shot and dropped him in one shot. But it was only 50 yards less, but I passed up the other shot. The other one, I knew I wasn't going to be able to get as stable. I knew the wind was howling, so I passed up on that shot. And I think a lot of it comes down to, you know, the position you can be in, the confidence you have with your cartridge, but how well you know it. Are you doing a turret system, a holdover? You know, what are you doing for that? And then bigger, though, what about the wind? And so I think, you know, it really comes down to your ability, the elements, all those things kind of combined. So for me, like, I personally, you know, understand that. So I know, look, if I'm going to be standing freehand, or if I'm going to have standing sticks, or if I'm going to be sitting down with sticks, if I'm going to be leaning up against a tree, or if I'm going to be prone with my bipod, those are all my distances are going to change based upon just my position alone. Then you take into account of it the environment and the wind, and that's going to change into, you know, so all of those elements play into it. I think some guys think, look, I can hit something at 850 yards at the range every single time on a bench, you know, with, you know, their environment very controlled. You go out into the field and you throw in buck fever and all those things, and your distances change. So I think with experience, you know, hunters need to understand that. And, you know, like in that Berger article I read, you know, it said, hey, you need to be able to shoot a pie plate, you know, a vital zone 9 times out of 10 at that particular distance before you, you know, feel you can do it. So technology's there. You throw in, you know, your Kestrel units and measuring the wind. You throw in flat shooting calibers. It certainly has got to where people, you know, that the ability to shoot out further is certainly there. But the shooter and the elements, everything kind of has to combine for that. And I think that's an educational process that some people need to understand.
So what would you say? I mean, I'm just kind of trying to generalize it here, I guess. But if a guy, you know, a guy's packing a 6.5 300 and, you know, maybe a, I'll say a typical guy like me, you know, I don't have a weather, you know, I don't have a wind indicator. I don't have a Kestrel. I have a range finder, you know, and I definitely know the range that I'm shooting at. And I'm a guy that spends, you know, probably more than average time on a bench shooting rifles throughout the course of my life. And so I'm pretty comfortable, you know, executing a fairly good shot, but I'm by no means a professional bench shooter or anything like that. I mean, what just ballpark a general distance that you feel most...
Nah, you're trying to back me into the distance.
No, I'm not.
I just avoided it for 5 minutes like a politician.
I
Come
know,
on.
And I'm going to drag it out of you. That's my job.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, take the 6.5-300 for a second. You know, depending on what bullet you use, let's say you zeroed at 300 yards. You're going to have, you know, roughly 7 to 8 inches of drop at 400 yards. So right out to 400, if you zero it, it's going to be, depending on the bullet, 2.5 to 3 inches high at 100. You know, 200, it's going to be a few inches high still. It's going to zero at 3, and you're going to be 7 to 8 inches at 400 yards. You know, I mean, obviously, so then out to 400 yards of that caliber, I mean, really, it's just not a big deal. As soon as you go to 500, you know, that turns to, depending on the bullet, you know, with our 127 Barnes LRX, it's 19 inches. If you go with the heaviest bullet, it's 23 inches, you know, so it's roughly around 20 inches. Now, past 500 yards, obviously, it's going to start to drop a little bit more. And that's where it does come down into, you know, a lot comes down into optics at that point, too. And that's a big part of the conversation is your optics. So for the Thompson long range guys, they have custom reticles that they use, you know, through Leupold is the way their system is. And it's designed, say, for the 6.5-300, 33.78-257. So let's say I, for instance, I drew a sheep tag this year in Oregon, which we can talk about that later, but that was pretty cool. Amazingly cool, because there's 6 non-residents that draw it a year, and I drew an Oregon bighorn hunt, which is incredible. So on that hunt, I took the 6.5-300 with the Thompson long-range scope. I did it in our new Cryptic Altitude gun. And
I think that's a picture I posted on the
social
media.
Okay, that was a sheep from, yeah, you're right, actually, the one you posted yesterday. So for that, you know, for that hunt, I took the 6.5-300 with that Thompson long range scope. It's a holdover scope. You zero it at 3, and then he's got a dash for 400, 500, 600, a bigger dash for 7, 8, 9, and 1,000. So he's got a holdover system. You know, it's available for that. Obviously, there's wind to factor in. You know, I took that on that hunt. I used a Vortex though with a, you know, turret system. Their Viper, what is it, HDLR. You know, on the elk I shot here in New Mexico. And, you know, so that's, you know, for that one, I have a ballistics app. When I use ballistics AE, had that on my phone, had it in my pocket, had kind of the, you know, I knew it was half MOA clicks. I'm all dialed in with my 300 Weatherby, with my 180 grain Accubond, have it all dialed in there. So I knew, and I had practiced with it. I was confident when I dialed it into my ballistics app and I made that many clicks on my Vortex scope, that my drop would be right on. I mean, I was confident. That's just science. That's just physics, you know. Then again, you have to throw in the wind. You know, for that particular shot, like I said, it's 525 yards. I just think a big part of it's stability. And, you know, your points of contact you can have as a shooter as well. So my distance will go further. I use a carbon fiber bipod, those Spartan bipods. Mm-hmm. This guy, Rob Gearing, cool guy out of the UK. It's like the Spartan Javelin, and it's this cool little, you replace your front swivel stud with a little magnet cup dealie. And then I keep on my sling a carbon fiber bipod that weighs nothing, and I can just pull it out and pop it in the front with a magnet in like 2 seconds. It doesn't weigh hardly anything. And if I can do that combined, and then I'll throw my day pack, like I'm a Mystery Ranch day pack, I'll throw that under my buttstock on the back. If I have those two things, and I either have a turret system or a holdover system that I'm very confident in, it will push that range out significantly farther. Right. And that's where it's coming back. But if I can't put the pack on the back, or I can't use the bipod, if I start eliminating those, I go down like 50, 75 yards or 100 yards for kind of each of those, you know, and so my range really changes. So what I'm trying to say for me is, if I have the bipod on, if I have a pack on the back, if I have like a 6.5/300 either dialed in with the Thompson long range setup or some sort of turret system, I mean, at 525 yards when I shot that elk the other day, I could have gone a lot further and been very confident. There was no wind, was confident in all of that. So the confidence level was incredibly high. And so, you know, I do hesitate to say a number, but I personally would have been confident to go a lot further. Actually, that was with the 300 Weatherby, but either way, it carries a lot of energy out there far.
Yeah.
I would have had confidence to go a lot further. But like I said, the week before, I passed up a shot at 575 because I didn't have all that there.
Right. And that's the key right there, is it's not a distance. It's, you know, the effective shooting range, so to speak. You know, and I'm more familiar with archery for sure than rifles. But the principles are still the same. I mean, there's guys who could pick up a $300 youth bow and outshoot a guy who's got the, you know, $1,500 brand new Hoyt, Redworks RX1 that just came out, you know, because of whatever reason, he understands archery better. He practices more, is probably a big thing, but there's so many variables that guys just need to understand what those variables are. And then take a page out of your book and be able to call an audible and say, nope, you know, today the wind's blowing. I don't have, you know, I'm offhand or whatever the case is, you know, and that's, I think, like you're saying, I think is the problem. Guys, they go out to the range and they hit a metal 3 foot metal gong at 1,000 yards, and they're a 1,000 yard shooter no matter what.
Right.
And that just,
that's the false sense of it out there for sure.
Yep.
Is there needs, and that's where I say, you know, guys, maybe either underestimate or overestimate the wind, or not understanding, you know, your exact shooting position, and to be honest, also the position of the animal, is in there too. If he's slightly quartering away, that's going to make if you don't dope the wind just right, you have less room, you know, for error than you do if he's broadside perfectly. So all of those factors come into it. And I think, to be honest, that comes with experience.
Yeah.
And so the idea of kind of, you know, I'm going to be a 1,000 yard long range hunting shooter right out of the box type of guy. I think there's a lot of guys either missing or injuring animals, as a result of just a lack of experience, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
I know even for me in my personal journey, that's certainly the case, you know, and we've all taken shots we wish we wouldn't have, and, you know, have those regrets, or, you know, injure an animal and can't recover them and all those kind of things. And then you go, okay, I need to rethink this a little bit.
Yep.
So just because the tool exists doesn't mean that, you know, everybody's going to have the same minimums.
Yep.
I think everybody needs to have, different personal minimums regarding, hey, if I have a rest, what the wind is, et cetera.
So. Well, and speaking of the tool, I mean, I think fall back a lot on the caliber or maybe the ballistic coefficient itself of the bullet that we're shooting, and say, oh, well, you know, this 6.5 bullet, you know, is the rage now, and it'll pack its, you know, this many foot pounds of energy out to this distance. And so it's a 900 yard gun,
sure,
or a 1,000 yard gun, right, or whatever. Just because,
right,
the bullet's capable of that doesn't,
sure,
mean that you're going
to
hit
it. That's where, when I talk to when I talk to when I talk to people, you know, too, and like we'll say with Mark Thompson, his whole thing is, hey, Adam, what you have to remember is what your grandpa did is by designing his faster cartridges is things like wind, things like density, altitude, all those kind of things become less of a factor the faster it's moving. Yeah. And so, sure, you can shoot a 6.5 Creedmoor at 1,000 yards and you can hit a metal gong all day. And so, you know, you can totally do that, but throw in wind, you know, throw in your altitude, all those things become that much more. And so he says people, even with, say, our neck down cartridges like a 6.5/300 or 33.78, overestimate altitude or wind or those different things. And that's kind of the simplicity of our system is to go, I mean, you saw the, you know, the ballistics I just gave you on the 6.5/300. So when you have that, it's basically out to 500 yards. I mean, certainly 450 yards at 500, you know, you are going to have to, you know, adjust a little bit at 500, but for the majority of people to go, hey, up to 450 yards, you can aim almost dead on with a tiny bit of adjustment there past 400 right. yards. And really, you know, your wind and your altitude and those different things are going to affect it less and less. And so that's, you know, part of the advantage of that. You can take a 6.5 Creedmoor, shoot it out to 800 yards, but you're, you know, spinning your turret around and around and around, you know, trying to line it up. The longer it's in the air, the more, you know, your, you know, wind and elements can, you know, adjust the path of the bullet.
I remember taking 400 yard shots when I was maybe a kid first starting out. And you know what those looked like when I was a kid? It looked like you held over a foot over a deer's back, but that's just right. how it was back then. I mean, for, you know, just regular Joe guys like us that were out shooting with Grandpa's 280 Remington,
right.
you zeroed at 100 or maybe an inch high at 100 back then or whatever it was. And, mm-hmm. and then you just guessed. I mean, you had to literally hold over probably a foot or more over a buck's back and prayed that you hit him. And so, yeah like you're saying, that's just, you guys are just taking those variables out of the equation.
Changed a lot. And it's great because, you know, those of us that have hunted out west, there's, I mean, a lot of times there's a canyon in between you and that animal, and there's no way to get a stock on, you know, yeah. to really do it. So it's great to have the technology out there, you know, in the optics and the rifle, you know, in your, you know, different, you know, gear or things like a Kestrel to gauge the wind. I mean, those things are all great, but it doesn't mean that you're a long range killer. Right. you know?
Yep.
So, yeah.
So let's build the perfect, let's say you're a backcountry guy. Let's build the perfect, like Weatherby backcountry, hunting rifle. What walk me through your kind of your thought process there.
Sure. Absolutely. I mean, you know, for us, our kind of our flagship action, if you were to start with that, you know, is our Mark V. You know, my grandpa originally developed in 1958. We've, you know, upgraded a lot of things recently, the trigger, and we hand lap the barrels. And it's, we try to look at the Mark V that it's really kind of got a lot of custom level features at a production, you know, an upper end production price. And so, you know, we have our ultralight model, and then which takes a thinner barrel, you know, a fluted barrel. We, you know, have carbon fiber mixed in with the fiberglass and the stock and all those things. And so, you know, obviously with backcountry, you're trying to get, you know, your weight down, that's for darn sure. And so, you know, like even the elk hunt I just went on recently, there's one day we hiked 13 miles and, you know, as well as I, you get that in a day pack and everything, and you want to shed pounds. So I'm going to go with lightweight, but I'm also going to go with long range. So if I can combine those two, then I'm going to have the best confidence that I'm going to be able to lug the thing around and I'm going to be able to shoot farther. So for me, depending on the type of game and the size of the animal, you know, I'm gonna take a Mark V ultra lightweight, but that configuration we have, like say that altitude gun, you know, that I took on that sheep hunt in August this year, was really that gun. I just got some stuff from the guys at Cryptic, their new altitude line, and we matched the stock up with it and put a tungsten colored Cerakote on there, and you know, so it was a, you know, but it was a light rifle, but yet it was a 6.5/300, so I had the confidence in it, put the Thompson long range on it. So for me, sometimes that holdover, you know, thing rather than dialing in a turret, you know, is the way to go. And then it's the durability of the backcountry. You know, I've taken non-Cerakoted or non-stainless, just regular chromoly stuff on backcountry hunts, and, you know, I've definitely rusted some stuff. And so for me on a backcountry hunt, Cerakoting is like non-option. I mean, you have to have it now. Yeah. I mean, either that or stainless. We're just doing more in Cerakote due to its popularity, you know, from our customers. Also, it's a function and fashion thing. So with Cerakoting, you get, you know, the look, and you get the durability.
Right.
And so you kind of get both those. So for me, it's going to be the Cerakoted ultra lightweight type of thing. We have our outfitter Flat Dark Earth. We have our Cryptic Altitude. All those are built kind of on that platform, where in some of our smaller calibers, it's going to be a 5 3/4 pounder. With a larger caliber like the 6.5-300, it's going to be 6 3/4 pounds. But, you know, packing a punch at that, obviously, as well.
Okay. What are you building it in a 6.5-300, you said?
Yeah, I mean, that's going to depend on what game I'm chasing.
Yeah.
You know? So, I mean, I have, you know, people say, hey, what's the best all around? And, you know, if you had one gun, what would you take? I mean, the reality is I've never been in that position because I have a warehouse full I can choose from. So for me, I get the beauty of I can particularly pick any, you know, we have 14 calibers and I can pick which one's going to work best for that particular game.
Right.
You know, over the years, our 300 Weatherby has been hands down our number one seller over, you know, if you were to average it over all the years. And that is because the versatility, put it in 165 grain or up to a 220 grain. I mean, it's just, you take any North American game with it, you know. And so that's obviously, you know, been a big one. 257's been real popular. I think 257 for, you know, for a mule deer gun is a great, great gun. I mean, it's just flat shooting. That was my grandpa's favorite cartridge, and it's just screaming. And there's just not a lot in that 25 caliber, so it's a little different and, you know, sets us apart a bit in that. I've been using the 6.5-300 a lot just because it's new and want to do a lot of testing with whatever's new.
Yeah.
So we've been certainly using that a lot. And once in a while, it's fun to take the 3378 just because then you're, you know, especially on larger game, longer distances, you know, because you're, it's the fastest moving 30 cal out there. You either get recoil or noise with it. That's for darn sure.
I was just going to ask about muzzle brakes.
It's big. Yeah. So we have a muzzle brake, you know, that we, you know, our proprietary one, you know, that we put on. But, you know, so on our larger stuff, I mean, especially for me, it just gives me confidence. And, you know, if I have a 3378, I'm going to have a break on there. Otherwise, I'm going to develop a flinch. I'm not going to lie. So other guys will call me a sissy, but I'm not a huge guy, and that's just the way it works.
What do you think, and I don't have anything in mind here, but what do you think is the most overrated quality in, like, a general hunting rifle that guys are too worried about? Is there...
Man, that's a good question. You know, just like in any industry, there's things, you know, as a consumer, I buy in other industries too. And that's a great question. The things you kind of worry about and think that you need, and, you know, you come out with the greatest and you buy into the marketing scheme of it. I do that all the time as a consumer, whatever it is, that's for sure. Gosh, that's a good question. You're saying in a hunting rifle.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe a hunting rifle or even a caliber. I don't know.
No, that's, man, that's a good question. I mean, barrels are important. I mean, certainly for accuracy, you know, your stock.
Maybe what's the most underrated, I guess? What's the one thing guys aren't worrying enough about?
You know, I think, you know, this maybe is a side note of that, and tell me if this helps answer it, but, you know, one of the things I think in the firearms industry that's a bit weird is that guys, you know, a lot of people can be really particular about how much money you spend on a rifle. And some of the things, yeah, people overpay for certain, you know, types of things. But, you know, to be honest, in the past 5 years, the entry level for a bolt action hunting rifle that actually shoots fairly decent, that dollar amount is down in the gutter. I mean, it's crazy what you can get, especially this year has been kind of nuts in our industry, what you can get an entry level bolt action rifle for that'll actually shoot pretty decent. Now, it's going to have a black plastic stock and you know, kind of bang on the side of it. And it certainly sounds hollow and it's not going to look that cool and, you know, all those things. But the average guy can go out and shoot a deer with it, you know, and harvest a buck for the season. I think one of the things that's interesting is they'll complain about price and every little thing that you do. But firearms are something that, I mean, you know, handed down generationally that you often use or even hunt with. We hear all the time, I hunt with my grandpa's gun, and that those things happen. And so I think a lot of the things on products that just last, like say in a stock, you know, there's, you know, we make, you know, whatever, call them plastic stocks. We make on our more entry level, you know, stuff, particularly in our Vanguard line, you know, stocks that are, you know, injected molded polymer stocks. And they work great. I took one out recently, and it was part of a promo deal and was on that elk hunt. I took it out to a range out back, wasn't even trying to shoot a good group, shot a half inch with it right out of the box at 100 yards. You know, so I mean, it was a great shooting gun, and it had a injected molded polymer stock, plastic, right? But I think as you go up, you begin to get, you know, you get a fiberglass stock, you get aluminum bedding in it, or you get a hand-lamped barrel, and you start to add all that. Any one little feature isn't going to necessarily make or break it or make it a great gun. But I think for us, even our vision statement is we exist to inspire the dreams of hunters and shooters. And we know that our products end up in the hands of people. They make memories with it. They take their kid out, you know, for their first buck, or they go on their first African safari, or they shoot their first sheep, or they shoot their longest range shot, that we are a part of that. So the stuff that goes into our products is a lot of hand stuff. You know, we're a smaller company. We're not as big as Remington, Ruger, and Savage, and all the other big guys. We're, right. You know, we're a family-owned deal. And so we, even if you look at our new catalog, we tried to put the human element. You know, I got Brad on the cover who works in our custom shop and people's hands throughout it. And so a lot of it is the time and attention that goes into the rifle, not one particular feature. Again, I'm spinning around in a circle here, but is what is the quality that's put into it? And when you, you know, when you have that rifle, is it something you're going to be proud to hand to your kid or your, you know, your grandkid or whatever those things are? And just what we hear a lot is, you know, is quality craftsmanship or fit and finish of those things where you go, man, I hold this thing and the way it shoulders and the way, you know, when you pull that bolt back, we always joke when somebody grabs a rifle and they're looking at it for the first time, no matter what, they just open the bolt, they push it back in, you know, and they cycle that thing and how smooth is it? And it's a lot of those attention to detail. Now, is that going to mean you're going to be able to shoot further? Nah. Is it going to mean necessarily it lasts longer? I don't know, but it's something that you're proud of. And I think,
I think
a lot of the industry has gone down in the gutter with the price, and it just, I don't know, it kind of worries me.
Yeah. Well, a couple things came to mind. First, I think that those little things that give you confidence, you know, that you, like you kind of hinted that weren't really going to make you a better shooter. I would argue that subconsciously, at least they might.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing that came to mind is the irony here is, you know, $2,000-$3,000 rifles guys might scoff at because like you're saying, well, you know, they could go get a rifle is like the one piece of gear that isn't going to lose its value and is going to could be around forever.
Right.
I mean, guys are out now buying $2,000, $2,500 bow setups by the time it's all said and done. And it's out of date in 5 years. It's lost its value. It's not efficient. It's not, it's not even relevant anymore. You know, so to speak. And yet it's just, to me, it's really funny. To me, a rifle, you don't buy it because it works. You buy it because of the legacy behind the brand. You buy it because of the story that the brand has and the legacy that it's going to, continue on in your own family and generations to come and stuff like that. And so then price becomes irrelevant to me, but
I agree. And people say they can't afford it or this, it's a priority. They can, they might go out and buy a big screen at Costco that weekend, but they complain about a $50 markup on one gun versus the next and what it has over this brand, you know, but they'll drop $1,000 on a new iPhone or, you know, so it's, you can, these guys can afford it. Well, what do you pay to go on a backcountry hunt? I mean, for all your other gear. And I agree. It is the one thing. You know, how much do we spend on our iPhones and iPads and whatnot? And it's technology, and 2 years later, it's outdated, but we're fine to buy something else. Now, obviously, I'm biased because I'm running a gun company.
Right.
But I mean, I feel that even with my kids. I got, when my son, you know, turned, that one was when he was 12, you know, I got him. It was a Vanguard rifle, but I got him a walnut stock. So it was a traditional high gloss Weatherby stock, put his name in the bolt and did that sort of deal. And sure, even at retail, it was less than $1,000. Obviously I didn't pay that for it, but I would have. And I would have even if not, because he's going to have that gun and show it to his kids someday. And he's going to say, and sure enough, he shot his first two deer with that same rifle. And he's going to tell people, this is the gun I got from my dad. It has my name in the bolt, has these different things. And he's going to tell his kids or grandkids about it and show the photos of the first whitetail, first blacktail, you know, that he shot with it.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, you're not necessarily going to pull out, no offense to all the other gear we take, because it's all very important, but you're not going to pull out your day pack. Or you're not going to pull out your binos.
In 30
you're
years.
You're going to pull out your rifle.
Yeah. You know what's funny about that is we just went through this in my family. So my grandpa originally bought a a rifle. Unfortunately, it wasn't a Weatherby, so I won't say what it was. But it was a 6mm, and it was the first gun that kind of all of his kids started out hunting with. My dad being one of them, and then that got passed down. It was the first deer that I shot gun that I shot a deer with. It's the first, you know, it was just that gun for all the kids. 6mm is a great round for that. Eventually, you know, we got in this phase where kind of everyone grew up and we didn't, you know, now it's like great grandkids of my grandpa that would be coming up. And so there's this big gap. And anyway, the gun got sold for one reason or another. Back up, it was a pump action. And if you've ever hunted with kids, a pump action rifle is like a 12-year-old kid, that's the worst thing you can give them, because it was old, it was so hard to get that thing, and you were just terrified that your dad was gonna yell at you if you didn't just slam that thing down and chamber that round without it holding up. Anyway, well, just the other day, we kind of got talking about it, and we got talking about all the stories behind it, and my dad, you know, all of a sudden it hit him like, oh, crap, I really wish we wouldn't have sold that gun. And so now we're, you know, we're like regretting it. And it just, it goes into your point of, you know, in 30 years, you're not going to pull out, you're not even going to have your boots that you wore on your first hunt. You know, I don't even know what boots I wore. I don't know what pack I was wearing, really. I don't, but you will have that rifle. That's priceless.
Anyway. No, I agree. And that's why it's, you know, fun to do what we do. And, you know, what we hear a lot of times from people is, I've always wanted to own a Weatherby. Again, it's that brand we're, you know, growing into. And so when somebody does finally get that Weatherby and take it out and harvest their first animal with it and sends in a picture, I mean, that to us, that just excites us and keeps us going.
What is the next, let's say, I guess I'm winding down here, but what is the next, 5 years. What does the next 5 years look like at Weatherby?
Sure. You know, we do have a lot of, in the product realm, a lot of ideas new stuff we're going to introduce. You know, we laugh as you even talk about a bolt action rifle and, you know, versus even a bow that's outdated. But the funny thing about bolt action rifles are, like, it's a really old technology. It's funny, in our industry, you take a 1911, it's like, you know, 100 years old, and there's still 500,000 of them sold every year.
Just
it's like,
works.
Go figure, you know. Yeah. What else out there do you buy stuff that's that old? You don't do it in anything else but guns, it is. And so, you know, when we look at coming out with new stuff, you know, we'll continue to have, recognizing, you know, that our foundation is on high velocity. We do have a lot of things lined up in the cartridge world. So we're going to continue to push the envelope there with some new and exciting things, you know, and then just some different innovations, you know, within our rifles. We're working on our custom shop a lot to kind of get it really back up and going. So there's going to be just a lot of new, you know, new materials, both in barrels and receivers and different things. So there'll be a lot more offerings in our custom shop that we're really going to be moving towards. And there'll be some change in our shotgun line. I mean, all the way across, we have, of course, I kind of can't tell you all those things yet, but we have a 5-year, you know, product roadmap right now, you know, that we're on, and, you know, we're excited about doing that. And like I said, really, you know, really grown into our brand and you know, even on the marketing side, a little bit everywhere. It's just, I think it's an exciting time for Weatherby, and the direction that we're headed.
With speaking of marketing, with social media platforms being as they are, and that change, how have you seen that affect your company, and what are you guys doing to, change with that?
Yeah, we have the advantage that we're smaller, and, you know, we're not owned by a big corporation or anything, so we can kind of move and adjust quickly. So that's the advantage. The disadvantage is we're not big, so we don't have as much resources or money, you know. So, but things like social media, you know, yesterday I did a Facebook Live deal about our new products, and, you know, hey, let's just do that. Let's go set up a camera in the showroom, and we'll do that. It didn't cost us anything. And so there's a lot of opportunities, certainly with social media. You know, we don't currently sponsor any television shows. We do all our video. We try to do some real top-notch stuff, but we do it all online, knowing that that's, you know, where things are going. And so we, both in social media and online platforms for even video and other marketing opportunities, know statistically that, you know, it is, it's not as moving that way. It's there. That's where it is.
Right, right.
And it's where the hub of good quality information's at. I mean, you know, there's certain challenges that lie within that, but we know, you know, we got to be on the cutting edge of that in order to make things happen. I mean, there still is, we still advertise, you know, print advertising. I think, you know, just like we have old bolt action rifles, you know, and our industry isn't incredibly innovative within that. Guys still enjoy, I still enjoy when I get a new, you know, when I get the new month of one of my favorite magazines, I still pull it open and flip it page after page. You know,
right.
Sure, I can listen to podcasts and YouTube channels and all those things, but there's still a lot of guys in our industry that love, you know, traditional marketing and print media, you know, and, you know, I still enjoy getting, you know, a good magazine and flipping it and smelling the pages and all that kind of stuff too. And I think there's still some old school guys that like that. So we'll have our hand in there, but a lot of what we're working on is getting more and more digital for sure.
Right. Right. Okay. I got to throw in one question from a guy that you're familiar with. And I think you responded to it, so this won't be as a shock to you, but Mark the Muley Slayer Smith himself, he wants to know, when is Adam Weatherby going to team up with Muley Slayer on a backcountry mule deer hunt?
Yeah, I know. He just put that out there yesterday. So, I mean, what am I supposed to say, Mark? No, I would love to go hunt with Mark. He's such a great guy, so authentic, so passionate, you know, about mule deer hunting specifically. And just, yeah, just a great guy. So, no, I would love to share hunting camp with Mark. That's for sure. So,
well,
I'm sure it'll happen.
As his name might as well be Mark the Weatherby Muley Slayer Smith, because as passionate as he is about mule deer, and I know because I've hunted with him, trust me, he's more passionate about Weatherby rifles.
That's so cool. So. No, it's awesome when you get people out there that really get behind your brand. You know, I think Mark's a guy, there's a lot of our competitors that make excellent products, but it is something about a brand. And I think, say for Mark, it's about maybe the personality of our brand. You know, I know, you know, we share kind of the same, you know, beliefs in our faith, and there's just different things you tend to resonate with a brand. It might be the style of marketing, it might be whatever. You know, a guy like Mark, he just, man, you know, I don't know if we could do much wrong to spin him out right now and have him go after one of our competitors. So he's in. And that's, you know, one thing about social media too, is that, you know, you begin to do that. And I think that's a huge thing, is you get these brand influencers and guys that are really loyal to your brand out there. And I know when I, you know, whatever earlier, I mentioned that bipod from that guy and that I use is in the UK. It's a small company. It's somewhat of a startup. I don't get a buck from it, but why do I say that? Because I believe in the product. I've shot several animals with it. The system's very intuitive. It's very innovative. It's new. It's different. And so I believe in that brand.
Yeah.
And so I'm going to promote it, not because I get anything from it. I don't get a buck from it. Well, I guess I did get a free bipod from it. But, but you know, other than that, it's like, you know, now I think at the same time you get guys out there who do just want free gear. And so they go out there and maybe promote something that they don't totally believe in, because they do want to be sponsored. And we get emails every single day from people wanting to be quote brand ambassadors every single day. And some of them just want free gear and some of them really believe in our brand, you know?
Yeah.
So, but Mark's a guy who, it's great to have
Mark,
you know, on our team.
Mark is a perfect example. I think if I was running a company, you know, mm-hmm. whatever it was, I mean, not that I didn't know what a Weatherby rifle was and not that I didn't understand the quality. But I look up to Mark so much and respect mm-hmm. him and who he is. Like you said, we're, you know, we're all Christians as well. And, mm-hmm. and because Mark believes in Weatherby, all of a sudden I'm like salivating, like, oh man, like I got to get rid of this rifle so I can get a Weatherby. And like, I want to be a part of that cool kid group too. You know, it's just,
well,
it's
part of,
and
you know, part of hunting when you get out there and it's just, it's talking about half the time you're talking about gear. Oh man, you got those new wool socks. Tell me about those wool socks.
Yeah.
And you just geek out on wool socks for a long time, you know, especially if you're a backcountry hunter and you're putting, you know, you're putting miles and miles and miles on your feet or on your pack, or you're carrying a rifle or on your gear is really important when you're a backcountry hunter.
Yeah.
You know, it really is.
Well, and I was going to tie it into, you know, to kind of the social media thing we're talking about. I mean, I'll bet you in my life, no offense to marketing schemes or anything like that, but I've probably seen dozens of Weatherby, TV commercials throughout my, 31 years or whatever. I never got the same feeling as when I see like my, a social media influencer like Mark using that. Anyway, it's just interesting.
Yep.
Like you said, how it's not changing. It's already changed. It's there.
Mm-hmm.
On the marketing
side. Somebody you trust, and then they trust it, and all of a sudden you trust it.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Cool. So I roll through just this fire round of questions. And the first one, I'm actually interested, because you're definitely a rifle guy. I'm actually interested to see what your answer is here. So I'll just roll through these. Mm-hmm. For archery, mechanical or fixed blade broadhead?
Oh man, I don't archery hunt at all.
I know, that's why I want you to answer. It's a very fresh perspective.
Therefore, I don't have an opinion because I don't archery hunt. What's funny is, I think sometime in my life I'll probably pick it up.
What would you on your arrow right now if you're going to go hunt elk in Nevada with us next year for an archery?
I don't know because I haven't even. I literally just so don't even live in that world because, I mean, between our rifles and shotguns, I just live and breathe this stuff every single day, and that's the reason why people go, "Why don't you archery hunt?" It's like, well, I'm out. I can't. I'm trying to run a business and I try to get out and hunt as much as I can. And every time I do, it's using or testing our product or showing somebody else our product or filming the product or photoing the product. So, I have to just bypass that one. I don't want to give an opinion. Somebody's like, well, that guy's an idiot. Well, I am an idiot when it comes to archery.
No
clue.
That's the point of these questions is it doesn't matter. You're not an idiot one way or another. Cause I mean, just be prepared the day that you go on an archery hunt,
what I would do is I'd call up one of my buddies that archery hunts and I'd ask them and I'd go with what they say.
Smart.
How's that for an answer?
That's perfect. Well, just be prepared though. You're going to get bombarded with what are you shooting, a fixed blade or mechanical? Neither one's right. So, well, how about this one? Elk, mule deer, or antelope?
Elk. Well, kind of depends on where. I love, certainly out of those two, elk and mule deer the most. I think it depends. If I can do an early season rifle hunt where they're still bugling, then I would choose elk.
Oh, yeah.
But a later season mule deer hunt has its certain things with it. But the rush of bugling elk, there's just nothing like it.
What's your dream hunt?
I have a lot. a lot on my list, certainly. I've shot two sheep, so I got a stone in the desert left. And in my life, I'd like to get the North American Grand Slam on those. So that would be fun. I drew a bighorn and I did that doll hunt. But some overseas things, I want to do New Zealand tar. I know a guy who does some kind of backcountry stuff over there, with that, do a do-it-yourself New Zealand tar hunt, I think would just be so different and so fun. So that's on there, not because of the trophy itself, if you call it that, but, because of the rugged, steep terrain and to go kind of learn something like that and when I say do-it-yourself, do it myself with somebody else who's done it themselves. If that makes sense.
It
so yes, I know a guy who, that's on there. So so that's certainly on the list. I think some more do-it-yourself in Alaska I want to do. It's as I get more time or as I get older. I love northern country, and so some more things in Alaska, I think, are certainly on the list. Alaskan moose is on the list.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of things on the list.
So next question then, if you could only hunt one state the rest of your life, what would it be in the, or country, I guess?
Yeah. Man. Yeah, that's a good question. With the current tag system, or you can draw whatever, whenever.
Either or, we'll see.
Yeah, man. I would say, gosh, I mean, that's just tough because I'm going through all the pros and cons in my head of each state, you know, that's for sure. I think, you know, Wyoming is diverse as far as the lower 48, has its diversity from your antelope to your elk to your muleys to your sheep, a little bit of everything.
Bears.
So Wyoming would be up there for me, but Alaska would be up there.
Yeah.
Certainly. Or Canada. I mean, I just love hunting Canada.
That northern country.
BC, man, BC, there's nothing quite as beautiful as BC. It's just gorgeous and just abundant with game. So, those would be a few of my tops. Yeah.
What's your favorite backcountry food item?
Ooh, good question. I mean, usually I'm, you know, like if I have my jet boil type of thing going on, I'm usually, my steady day consists of oatmeal, maybe mixed with some Mountain Ops protein or something in it in the morning. And then during the day is bars and jerky because you're usually out on the trail all day. And then for dinner, I mean, it's usually always an instant of some sort. You know, of course, when I hunt with my son, he insists we use Mountain House. but everybody knows after so many days, you just can't do that anymore.
Yeah, seriously.
But at the same time, we all make fun of Mountain House. But at the end of a really long day and you put in 10 miles or something, like, there's just nothing like it.
So,
but I tend to be a healthier eater, and I don't like to eat a year's worth of sodium in a meal. So I've tried some others, like Heather's Choice out of Alaska. You know, hunted with a buddy who was friends with Heather and got hooked up with that and started using that in Alaska a little bit. And that stuff's like, you know, healthy alternative. Actually used some Patagonia, made some. I tried this last year. So I'm trying some different alternatives, you know, to the instant. But that's usually what my day consists of.
So what
I think is like everybody else, isn't it?
Yeah, but what's your favorite? So for me, I have like one item. It's this those little smiley face fruit snacks, and I'm telling you, like, those can lift my spirits faster than anything. I have to have those in my pack. Like, do you have one little thing like that that's just like, these go
if
on
I have a really good if I have really good homemade trail mix,
there you go.
That's, I don't know, that's really, really good. It's something about when you don't open up a wrapper.
Yeah.
And you know, it's like, yeah. So I love really good trail mix.
Nice. Hey, yeah. Adam, I'll...
my favorite meal, actually, in a backcountry hunt is tenderloins over the fire at night.
After
I'm coming back to actually say
after
that.
After a kill, yeah.
Yeah, I would say still to this day, my doll sheep, we cooked up that night, the backstraps over the fire, got a thin rock, and did the old heat up the rock deal, and did that. And still to this day, that was my favorite meal ever.
You just won you just won that question. I've asked that enough times now. That's no one's thought of that, and that's the best answer I've heard is backstraps.
It's true. I mean, that's one of the beauties. I mean, when you rip them out and put them on that night, and for some reason, they're way more tender, even though everybody says you got to age the meat and hang it and everything. It doesn't matter. When you've been hiking all around, it's just the best ever.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, we'll wrap up here with maybe one more question. But first, where can people find you guys? Obviously, online, and then all the social media platforms. Weatherby, I think your Weatherby at Weatherby Inc. on Instagram, and then your Instagram is at Adam Weatherby.
Yeah, I think my Insta on Facebook's both Adam Weatherby.
Okay. And then what about shows or expos or stuff like that? Where's a good place just to like get their hands on your rifles?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, as far as backcountry related stuff too, I mean, so we're at Sheep Show this year up in Reno. Mm-hmm. I'll be there. Of course, the Western Expo, you know, with mule deer is a big show for us. We really, really have a great partnership with Mule Deer Foundation. You know, so we'll be there in February, you know, NRA, SHOT Show. Yeah, so we're definitely, you can get your hands on our stuff. We won't be at RMEF this year in Vegas. We often are, but we won't be this year in December. So, yeah, so for sure you can get your hands on some product system shows. Would love to meet any of your podcast listeners. So if I'm not in a meeting or whatever, I'm in the booth, just have them come up and interrupt, and would love to shake their hand and meet them. So I always love to especially meet, you know, just other customers, hunters, hear stories, all that kind of stuff's always fun. So.
Perfect. Yeah, we'll be there this year. We've actually got a booth for the first time.
Which show?
The Hunt Expo in Salt Lake.
Cool.
And so we'll be out and about, but I'll probably be stuck. I hope I am stuck just podcasting the whole time. So maybe we'll do a follow up or something like that.
That'd be fun. Cool. Yeah, nope, we'll be there for sure. I'll be there personally. So it'd be definitely fun to see you and some of your listeners and fans and things like that. Yeah. Be cool.
Yeah. Cool. Well, one last question, but first I like to give my guests credit. And for you all, I'd like to give you credit for, you know, obviously being a part of, just a legacy in the hunting industry, and continuing that kind of excellence, so to speak, that your grandpa and your dad have started and kept going. And then you've just picked up where they left off. Like to give you credit for being approachable. I think it says a lot when, you know, I get an email from you and you're the president of Weatherby Rifles and you're still answering my emails and willing to sit down with a guy like me on a podcast. It says a lot about who you are. So, but most importantly, I like to give you credit for being a family man and a Christian. Above that, I think the world needs a lot more of that. And we appreciate guys like you, standing up for what you believe in. So,
thanks, man. Thanks. Appreciate it. And hopefully, you know, I think this one thing stands out about our name or our brand a little bit is, you know, it's, like my dad always says, we put our names on the product. And so, you know, that means we know our name means a lot, whether it be on our products or the way we behave, our character, integrity, all those things are a whole lot more important. So, sure. That's what it's about. Perfect. So appreciate that, man. Yeah.
Why? So last question here. Why do you hunt the backcountry?
I think a few reasons. Do I have to have one?
No, you can have as many as you want.
I think the further I am in and away from roads and people, it does a few things for me. Number one, it disconnects me more, and I do live a fairly hectic and busy life, so it's the disconnect. Number two, you know, being a Christian and having a deep faith and belief in God, I seem to just connect with Him more. A deeper level when I do get away from those things, it gives me more time to sit there and reflect and kind of just be in awe of his creation and all those things. It even with people, it connects me with people more because you're, you know, further away from that. And then probably lastly, I love the challenge of it. I just am naturally a person, like over my life, I've done triathlons, I've done a number of things. I enjoy a good challenge. And when you're in the backcountry, it's, you know, whether you're packing out an animal or whatever you're doing, it's a bigger challenge. And I think the bigger the challenge, the greater the reward.
Perfect. Adam, thank you so much for jumping on with me, and I really appreciate your time.
You bet, man. Well, thank you so much, and we'll look forward to seeing you during the show season.
Okay, sounds good. Have a good day.
All right. Okay, catch you later. Bye.
Hey, everybody. Thank you for listening to the Finding Backcountry podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure you subscribe and mention it to your friends. But the best thing you can do, leave a rating on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. For notes and links to this and other episodes, please visit findingbackcountry.com.